Men wanted for hazardous journey. Small wages. Bitter cold. Long months of complete darkness. Constant danger. Safe return, doubtful. Honor and recognition in case of success. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, a short distance from the convergence of the north and south branches of the Antlered River in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight's quote comes from the likely apocryphal tale of an advertisement said to be placed by the famed polar explorer Ernest Shackleton while looking for help to mount an expedition to the South Pole. At the time, people were looking to push the limits imposed by geography and topography, and it is no accident that tonight's accompaniment, Himalaya by Vangelis, is named after the so-called Third Pole, but still evokes the other two just as easily. There's an argument to be made that the Moon and Mars are for humanity today what the interior of Antarctica was in the opening years of the 20th century, a frontier. Certainly, you can make a direct comparison between Mars and our southernmost continent, whose dry valleys near McMurdo Sound often stand in for the Red Planet on research expeditions. But a harsh environment isn't just limited to the south. Up in the north parts of Canada lies a series of polar desert islands, more accessible but just as forbidding as their valley counterparts. It is in this environment that our guest this week, Melissa Battler, a doctoral candidate at Western University, has done research on understanding cold springs. In addition to this scientific work, she's also spent a great deal of time simulating what it might be like as an astronaut exploring our most Earth-like neighbor in the solar system. Recently, Ms. Battler sat down with our own Alyssa Gilbert to speak about her experiences.
So I have Melissa Battler here with me today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you are a PhD candidate here with the CPSX. So if you could maybe tell us a bit about what you're researching and what you're working on while here.
I've been working on my PhD here for a few years. This is hopefully my last year. So The project has started to come together. I think we know what we're doing now. It's a study of cold saline perennial springs in the high Arctic. So basically, I'm studying a couple of different sets of springs in the Canadian Arctic. And the common theme that they both have is that they're both cold. You've probably all heard of Yellowstone springs, hot springs. There are many other well-heard of hot springs in the world. No one's really heard of cold springs. So the temperature of these ones kind of ranges from -5 to +5. So they're not icy cold. They're just colder than the 100 degree kind of boiling temperatures you sometimes hear of. And these ones are salty because they're flowing through salt domes in the subsurface. And because they're in the Arctic, it's a permafrost area, so they're flowing down through 400 to 600 meters of permafrost. So you'd think that they would freeze, but because they're picking up that salt from the salt domes in the subsurface, they're actually flowing, and they're flowing year-round, which is really interesting, too, because temperatures plummet down to -50 Celsius during the 24-hour darkness of the winter. So they're really cold, really salty, flow year-round, and stuff lives in them year-round. So that's pretty cool. We get these mineral formations, again, much like what you would see at Yellowstone. So there are sometimes colorful mineral crusts surrounding the springs. A lot of white, a lot of salt at the spring set that I'm mostly focused on. And the other set of springs has more iron minerals. So you see a lot of yellow and orange kind of minerals around there. Jarosite and that kind of thing that we also see on Mars. That's where the tie into planetary science comes in, is that these minerals that I see at my springs are similar to mineral deposits and also landforms that we've detected on Mars. Now, there's no confirmation that we have spring systems on Mars, but my hypothesis, and that of many others as well, is that some of these formations that we see on Mars are being formed by spring processes, or were formed by spring processes in the past. That's all well and good. That's a fun hypothesis. How do we prove that? That's really difficult to do.
So what you're doing here on Earth is kind of an analog for what you're looking for on Mars.
Yep, precisely. So most of the data that we have for the entire surface of Mars right now, it's orbital data. So we're looking at orbital spectral data. We have an idea of what the mineralogy is over the entire surface, but it's at a fairly large scale. We don't know the details of what the mineralogy is, and we also don't know everything. There are some areas that we're not really sure what we're seeing. There's some areas that are covered in dust, so we're not really sure what the minerals underneath are. And even when we do have a good idea of the mineralogy, we only know the very, very surface. We don't know the subsurface. So there are a lot of unknowns. What we can do is look at analogs on Earth, so places that are similar to sites that we, or at least we suspect are similar to sites on Mars that we're interested in learning more about. So I've been characterizing these two sites in a lot of detail, and I've already published, or I'm in the process of publishing those results, just characterizing the sites on Earth. The next step now, the final step that I'm working on, is gathering spectral data from my sites and getting a really good understanding of if these sites were on Mars and not on the Earth, the ones that I'm studying, what would we see from orbit? So that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out. And then once we have that information, then we'll be able to compare and we'll just have a better baseline so that we can approach these potential spring sites on Mars to better understand, could they have been spring sites? And if they were, well, then there are lots of really interesting implications, definitely for water and, of course, possibly for life. That is what drives me through all of this. Even though I'm not really studying biology, it's the hope that we can know where to land to look for signs of life. Taking the geological approach to searching for biology by looking at the clues that we have available to us right now with the current data set for Mars.
Right, and that's really the big motivation for going to Mars, is it not? That's kind of the body in our solar system that we think is a really good candidate for life. Is that correct?
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, there are others as well that Mars is definitely the closest and easiest to get to right now. I mean, it's the one we know the most about because it's closest. We've landed several rovers and landers on the surface, so we've gathered some fairly specific data about individual sites on the surface of Mars, so we definitely know more about it than some of the moon of Jupiter and Saturn that seem interesting, and they seem like they could potentially support life even now in the depths of some of these planets, possibly in an ice-covered ocean on Europa. There, you know, lots of people think that would be a really great place to look for life. I agree, it would be fantastic. It's just really hard to get there.
Hard to get there, right? Europa is one of Jupiter's moons, so it'd be pretty difficult to get there and to stay there.
And expensive. I mean, we know how to do at least many parts of that mission. I'm not really sure where the technology is for landing something on an icy body and not contaminating it. There are definitely complications with that. I think, technically speaking, we're not far away from being able to do that. It's definitely the funding is the problem.
Okay.
It's always difficult to fight for funds for the particular mission that you want to send.
You have been involved with a number of simulated missions in the Canadian High Arctic and also in Utah. I don't know if you could tell us a bit about those experiences, because they sound very interesting.
Those have been very enjoyable and illuminating.
I'm sure.
Yeah, now I've spent a lot of time on fake Mars. I have the Tuna Can Award for most time spent on fake Mars.
Oh, how many times?
Or the most amount of, the highest number of weeks, I guess, in a certain year or something like that. The most time per year, I think it was. I think it was close to 6 months on analog Mars.
Wow.
Yeah, I spent 4 months in the Canadian High Arctic at the Flashline Mars Arctic Research Station, and then another few missions. It was, at least another month and a half at the Mars Desert Research Station in southern Utah, training other crews in unrelated missions as well as preparing for the Arctic missions. Yeah, that was a busy year.
I'm sure it was. So can you tell us a bit about kind of your day-to-day life on these missions and what the goal would be and what you know, you and the rest of the crew were doing?
For sure. So the distinction, first of all, between the missions in southern Utah and the one to the high Arctic. The ones to southern Utah are usually 2 weeks in duration, and they're more of a training nature. So they're more, even if you're not planning on directly going to the Arctic from there, they're to give you a taste of what living and working in a Mars analog environment would be like, and just maybe giving you an opportunity to carry out one research project or whatever. But it's only a 2 week duration, so it's not a lot of time. But I'm going to focus more on describing our experience at the Arctic Research Station, because that was a very intense 4 month mission. We had a crew of 7 people, and we were conducting 22 different research projects, so we had a fairly regimented schedule.
So that's very much a simulation of what it might be like on Mars. You're there for a long time, you're in a very secluded area, you're doing lots of different projects, you're with a small amount of people.
Yeah, it was definitely a full-scale simulation. So a lot of the ones that go to the Mars Desert Research Station, they're not necessarily a full-scale simulation, because you don't have time, maybe, to simulate the time delay, which was one thing that we did simulate. Yeah, we were definitely doing everything we could to make it feel like we were on Mars. We were following 5 priorities during the 4 month mission. The first one is safety. So above all else, you know, we had to protect ourselves because we were a long ways away from any kind of medical help if we did get into trouble. But other than that, our next priority was to stay in simulation all the time. And we had constraints that were both physical and psychological to make sure that we were really, truly feeling like we were on Mars all the time. And that was important because we were conducting many scientific studies, which was a third priority, the science, which required you to be in a Mars simulation state of mind or Mars simulation physical environment. And then after the science, the fourth priority was education and outreach. So we spent some time talking to summer camps, because it was during the summer, and different school groups. And then our fifth priority was our own comfort. So we were quite busy. We didn't always have time to deal with that last one.
At least it was on the list.
It was on the list. It's true. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that's how a real Mars mission would be. You'd be pretty busy. There's going to be a lot to do. A lot of concerns with safety, science.
Absolutely. So can you describe the location of the mission and the housing situation and stuff like that?
The Mars Arctic Research Station is located on Devon Island, right at the rim of Houghton Crater. So this is in the Canadian High Arctic. It's in a kind of desert area, so the air is fairly dry a lot of the time, so there's very little vegetation. So it really looks like you're on Mars. So the building that we were living in, it kind of looks like a giant soup can. Cylindrical type structure. Not very big. It was 8 meters in diameter and 8 meters tall, divided into 2 stories, and there were 7 people living in there, very close quarters, living there for 4 months, and we're at the rim of a crater for various reasons. The whole habitat was constructed there for various reasons, but most importantly, that is a potential landing site that you would want to go to on Mars, is to a crater rim, because craters are great places to study for lots of reasons, including looking for potential signs of life. So we were in isolation for sure. Devon Island is the largest uninhabited island in the world. We were very far away from hospitals or any true medical help if we needed it. We all had first aid training, but psychologically we definitely felt that we were isolated.
How long would it have taken if someone had broken their leg or something like that? If you had to get out, how long would it have taken you to get to the nearest hospital?
Worst case, if we were fogged in, could be a week or more. Who knows? But if conditions were just right and it was a sunny, clear day where we were, as well as sunny and clear where the airport is in Resolute or wherever a medical helicopter was coming from, it could be 5-6 hours, something like that, but you would never be guaranteed medical help right away. That's just until you get back to Resolute, where there's a nursing station, I believe. I think there's a nurse usually there. Yeah, you didn't want to assume that you had 6 hours.
And that's one thing people don't really think about when we think about sending humans back into space, and especially to Mars, where you're 8 months away. You know, you have to think about what it would be like to not have a hospital down the road or not have a Home Depot down the road, you know, if you need
Absolutely.
A certain tool or something. So these types of missions are really, really beneficial for that kind of knowledge, so that once we do send people to Mars, we'll have a much better idea of what can happen and what to be prepared for.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the goals of running any analog mission is just to develop a list of questions for your next analog mission. We don't even know what some of the questions are yet that we're going to be asking, and you don't know until you're thrown into that environment and you don't have that particular wrench that you need to fix that particular whatever that broke. So it's true, you do need to be prepared for just about anything. So we did have engineers on our crew, and they had a good supply of tools and pieces, and we needed to make use of those to fix up some of our science equipment that failed. Some equipment was damaged during shipment, and that could certainly happen on the way to Mars too. So right. You need to have the people with the skills to be able to fix the equipment in case it breaks, and of course the scientists to be able to conduct the science properly in the field. You do need to have a highly trained crew, and of course the medical side of things too. You need to have at least one person with decent enough medical training to help you, but in any case you're not going to have access to a full hospital, that's for sure.
So speaking of the crew, what type of people were on this mission with you? That you had a crew, was it 7 or 8 people total?
Yeah, we had 7 people on our crew. It was 3 female and 4 male crew members, all from Canada and the US. And you would think, wow, that's not a very multicultural crew. And that's what we thought at first, too. Funny thing, there's a great cultural difference between a gentleman from Quebec and a gentleman from Texas.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. So it's funny. We didn't think we were going to learn any lessons about multicultural crews and just the challenges that are associated with introducing different cultures and different languages, because our crew member from Quebec, his first language was French. Yeah, so there were more challenges than we expected, just with crew dynamics. Nothing really huge happened, like there were no fights that broke out or anything, but it was definitely very psychologically challenging, especially for those two to just understand each other. And spending our 2 weeks together before we went into the Arctic wasn't enough to reveal that there would be any kind of an issue whatsoever. I mean, they got along just fine, don't get me wrong, the whole crew is still friends, but there can be feelings of exclusion if there are, you know, misunderstandings based on just cultural differences that you don't explicitly discuss before you get into an extreme situation where nerves are sort of frayed. Yeah, it was a great crew, though. It was scientists and engineers, and we each had an area of specialty, be that in the sciences or engineering. And we all led various studies. Like I said, there were 22 different studies, so we were kept busy at all times by everyone on the crew, really. So it was a good balance overall. I mean, we definitely got along quite well, and we're still friends now, is the bottom line there.
Well, that's good. Yeah. So when they were choosing the crew to do this, was there some kind of psychological testing or something that you had to go through, or was it just a purely volunteer thing and they took the first 7 people who volunteered?
Somewhere in between. It was a volunteer thing, that is true. It was funded by the Mars Society and the Mars Society of Canada, and we did have some space agency funding as well, and industrial funding and sponsors too. But the way that the crew was selected, it was almost entirely people who had experience at the Mars Desert Research Station, and therefore they were known by the people who were doing the selecting. So they already had an idea of how well we would perform in a similar situation since we had done it already. So there weren't psychological tests, but there were other criteria that they were looking for. One of the biggest criteria was the command style, well, for the commander anyway. They were looking for a consultative command style rather than a military command style, because when you're dealing with non-military personnel, scientists, for example, we don't necessarily respond to authority in a way that someone that was trained and had a military background would. So we as a crew all responded to this consultative command style. So as commander, it was my job to get feedback from everyone and make sure that everyone felt that their voices were heard. So I had to lead daily meetings. So we were self-guided more than we were guided by mission control. We had a mission support team, but like I mentioned earlier, we had a 20-minute time delay, so it wasn't reasonable to get instructions from mission control every single day. It was more reasonable for us to use our eyes on the ground and come up with our own plan and then report back to mission control. So every morning we would get together as a crew and come up with the plan for what we were going to do together. And because I had a history of exhibiting that sort of a command style at the Desert Research Station, I was selected along with 3 people that I applied together with, because we already knew that the 4 of us were a really good team, that we would work well together. So they valued that, and that's why the 4 of us were selected, as well as 3 others who were highly qualified in their individual fields and had good reputations of doing really good Mars analog research.
So what do you think was the most difficult part of doing these types of simulated missions, and what did you find that was easier than maybe you thought it was?
Yeah, it's a tough one. The common themes that came up just in our daily discussions of things that were difficult were, you know, just not being able to feel the air on your face, because I didn't really go into detail before, but you had to wear a spacesuit every time you went outside, or a simulated surface suit more realistically. you know, you felt kind of isolated and self-contained, and that was a little bit difficult, but I wouldn't say that was the biggest challenge by any means. One of the bigger challenges was the fact that you are in close quarters with these seven people who you are generally very good friends with, but everyone gets frustrated. Think about going on a camping trip with your family. You might discover what the threshold is for the amount of time you can spend with your little sister. I know I've done that before. But it's like that with any good group of friends or family. There's going to be a threshold to what you can take or how much time you can take, not having any alone time. So it was a little bit difficult not really having any sort of space to go and really truly be alone. We had our own quarters. Like, we had our own individual little rooms where we would sleep. We had doors that closed and everything, but the walls were paper thin. So if you needed a good scream, you certainly couldn't do that with everyone hearing
you. You'd have to get into your spacesuit, go through the airlock, and then go outside.
Yeah, that's the way it was, but we didn't really have any big problems with that, because like I said, for the most part, we got along really well, and it's a funny thing. When we look back at the pictures, we see that most of the time, although we each did have our own rooms and our own little desks we could have worked at, a majority of the time we were all crowded around the kitchen table with our laptops, all working, like, elbows touching, just side by side. So I mean, that certainly could have been worse. Just the overall setup was definitely new. And could have been worse, but definitely a challenge. Some things that were easier than we expected, I guess the fact that we got along that well and that we had so few problems, that was a good one. And going back to a more difficult thing, I already alluded to the cultural challenges. So that was something that we just did not anticipate whatsoever. And it did lead to some hard feelings during the mission. And once we got out of simulation and were able to discuss the things that had been frustrating some of the individuals, it was really eye-opening. Like, you get into this state of mind where you just need to maybe be tough and prove yourself. A lot of astronauts do this. They won't act weak. And we sort of noticed that a little bit, I guess. Just everyone needed to be tough and, you know, maybe keep in some of the things that were bothering them. So that's interesting.
So that is really cool that you simulated what it was like to be on Mars, including the Mars time for a certain portion of your 4 months there, right? Yeah. So that's, what is it, 24 hours, 30...
Yeah, about 40 minutes
or something. Yeah. So how is that?
Different people reacted differently. I loved it. I loved it so much. I loved having the extra 40 minutes in a day. Every day it surprised me, and in such a wonderful way.
Right, if you ever want an extra hour in the day, move to Mars.
That's
right?
Just it. That's what it felt like. That's what it was. And of course, we could do this because we had 24-hour sunlight during the summer. So it didn't really matter what time we went out to do our exploration and to conduct our science. We'd always have sunlight, and we knew how the shadows moved up there. So we, you know, part of us knew that it was actually midnight when it said that it was 2 p.m. or whatever. I really enjoyed having the extra time, and it was really fun kind of traveling around the world. So we would be delayed by almost an hour every day, which you can think about that as being like jet lag. You're moving an hour west or whatever every single day. Yeah, it was neat because for the first few days we were still on the same clock as North America, and then as we eventually moved around to Australia, we spent more time talking to our mission support people in Australia than we usually did. And it was a neat experience that not many people get to have. Yeah, I really like that at the end of the day, usually I'm pretty stressed out still before bed. I'm, you know, still trying to finish up that last task right before I go to bed. And we were doing a sleep study as well, and our sleep physiology doctor told us, you know, it's very important to relax before you go to bed. So I want all of you to make sure you get 8 hours every night and try to spend at least 20 minutes reading or relaxing before bed. And that was just so hard to find the time to actually do that. But when we were on Mars time, your body, you just know when that 24-hour period is up and it's time to go to bed. So you get to that wall and then realize, oh, wait, I actually have an extra 40 minutes. That gives me 20 minutes to finish this task and 20 minutes to relax. So I was sleeping better. Some of us were having more naps because it was, you know, more awake time. We weren't sleeping for longer, even though the day was longer. And we'd get hungry at weird times. But overall, it was a really neat experience. I enjoyed it.
My final question for you, I guess. I often, when I go to the classrooms, we often talk about human space exploration and if we should do it. And I often hear from the students and from the public in general that they kind of think it's a waste of money almost. Mm. What would you say to the public to kind of convince them that, yes, we should be sending humans out into space?
So as a scientist, the most, you know, measurable and direct one is to answer some of the questions that I want to answer about Mars and about other planets, and particularly the question, is there life elsewhere other than the Earth? Can we find life on another planet? It's just such a burning question for so many people. It's not as efficient to explore with rovers and with robots. They just take so much longer than people do to explore. A trained geologist almost has this intuition about where to go to look for things. You know, it's just second nature. We spend so much time in the field looking for these things on the earth. The amount of science that the Opportunity Rover has done, it's done a phenomenal amount of science. It's gathered a ton of awesome data, but it hasn't really traveled that far. It's kind of traveled the distance that a human could go and really thoroughly study in, maybe a couple of weeks, and it's been a number of years.
Yeah, so. I think it's gone, what, about 30 kilometers or something in 8 years?
Yeah. So, I mean, a human could really study that in, you know, a few days and do the same amount. So you can look at it that way, but the thing that actually strikes me even more than that is just, I think it's just, you know, it's our destiny to get off of this planet and to go out and explore. We are explorers by nature. Humanity has been exploring. I mean, we've spread throughout the world and sort of, we're driven by this passion to explore, at least many of us are. I just think we need to have something to work towards, to increase our knowledge or to just better ourselves. And through doing this kind of exploration, we're often developing things that improve our quality of life, even in third world countries on the earth, water purification systems and, you know, better recycling systems. So we need to have some kind of driver to develop these things. And war, a lot of things are often developed when there are wars, but this is one of those positive areas where all of humanity can celebrate and kind of do something good together. Like, if you think about the Apollo 11 mission in 1969, I've heard that that's one of those moments in history, which sadly I wasn't born yet, so I didn't witness this, but I've heard, you know, people around the world were watching their TVs and just kind of celebrating this one event that was happening, and that just doesn't happen very often.
No.
So it's something that can inspire. It's something that can inspire kids to go into science and technology. It's something that you can get really passionate about and overall improve our qualities of life.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For being here with us, and hopefully we can talk to you again in the future.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we all just listened to my interview with Melissa Battler, who's a PhD candidate here in CPSX. She talked about her research first, which was quite interesting, talking about how she's studying these cold springs up in the Canadian tundra or Arctic, and how there's these living organisms in these areas, which is really cool. So she's kind of talking about these, what we call extremophiles, these organisms that can live in really cold environments or high-pressure environments. I don't know if anyone had any thoughts on that kind of study.
Well, I think it's pretty cool. You found these things in hot springs, cold springs, deep underwater, deep underground. You have things that can live in space, right? What are they called? Water bears?
Water bears are the tardigrades.
So there's a whole variety. I can only imagine how that would compare to actual living life on Mars.
Right. Even life on the other moons or planets, like Europa, which is pretty cold.
Yeah, these are all cold places, oceans under the surface of Europa, perhaps.
Yeah, and these extremophiles are data points that we can try to use to make guesses about what the limits are for DNA and carbon-based life.
Yeah.
And what environments they can handle, what are the temperature and acidity limits and things. Melissa's talking about these hypersaline springs that are so salty that they can keep running in very cold temperatures. Obviously, the bacteria that live in there have to be adapted to these very strange conditions.
You mentioned the limits that these can live at as well, but it can also really show us what life might look like on other planets. So Dave mentioned the tardigrades, and we actually have an outreach activity that we do on tardigrades. These tardigrades go into this, it's called a tun state. So what they do is they basically dehydrate themselves. And this is how they can live in these extreme environments, from really hot to really cold temperatures, high radiation, like up to 50,000 rads. They've been exposed to the vacuum of space. They can live in all sorts of environments, and it's because they go into this tun state. But in this tun state, if you were to look at them, they don't look alive. So really the question becomes, if we do search for life on Mars or Europa or wherever, how are we going to recognize it?
The interesting thing, of course, is that the bacteria living in some of these saline springs and other extreme environments, in many cases, these are not in any kind of dormant state. They're active and they're metabolizing and they're exsolving gases and things.
Yeah, for them it's the norm.
Yeah, and they would actually die if they were living in a freshwater lake. So the Phobos Grunt mission, they were actually sending some tardigrades to Mars, right? To Phobos, right?
Yeah.
But unfortunately that mission didn't make it, but it's pretty cool that mission planners are thinking about these kinds of experiments to do, to really see how far life, as we know it, can actually go, limit
wise.
So we could have established a colony on Mars.
Yes.
Of bacteria.
Of tardigrades.
Even before we get there.
No, they're not bacteria.
Oh,
these
guys have
like 8 legs and they have like a simple brain system, and it's really, they're really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting to see how well these organisms could have survived the trip to Phobos and back. So anyway, you know, it's interesting that Melissa is looking at these environments on Earth, because they are very unusual environments even for Earth, trying to understand how they form and how they behave and what they look like so that we can try to recognize similar things on Mars. Because even this far ahead of sending humans to Mars, you have to start planning on which places you will go to and how you will get to them and how you will recognize them. The preparations for Mars exploration start very early.
Yeah, well, I guess once you know these environments well enough, then it's important to know whether a human can actually survive in them, even if they're cooped up in a tin can, right? Really interesting to hear how she spent 4 months just in a little, what you call it, a soup can. That's pretty brutal, trapped with 7 other people for... That would drive me pretty crazy.
I was just going to say, that is something that you have to be a particular type of person to be able to do. I know I couldn't do it, but, I mean, it was her and it was 7 other, or it was 7 people?
Altogether 7
people total.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that they're still really great friends now and are able to talk to each other. Right, I mean...
7 people enter, 1 person leaves.
I've heard that really the timeline in order to start seeing the psychological effects of this kind of thing is 6 months or more. So maybe doing the 4 month study, they didn't get to that point where they were literally gonna reach crazy point. Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
And 4 months is not enough for a Mars trip, right?
No, of course not.
It has to be 6 months back.
This is a great starting point, though. I believe this was the first of this type of mission that was longer than 2 weeks. I'm not entirely sure about that either, but I do remember she did give a talk about it a couple months ago, and she was saying that this was one of the first very long missions to simulate what it is like to be on Mars.
Yeah, you talk about the difficulties of living in confined spaces. I was reading the results of some relatively long duration Soyuz missions that the Soviets did back before they had Salyut and Mir. You know, Soyuz is even a more confined space than Melissa had access to, and they would have 2 people in there for 10, 20, 50, 70, 90 days. The mission result was summed up with the phrase, canceled early because, quote, crew conditions became untenable. It's definitely difficult, and hopefully you would have a little more space than that on the way to Mars, but, you know, maybe 2 years round trip.
All right, I mean...
Psychologically, you need to be really strong to be confined with at least few people, and they are the only person you see all around, so...
I mean, at least on Earth, you have this opportunity that you can connect with people on a very easy... It's very easy to do it, and it's real time, right? If you're on Mars, you can't have real-time conversations with your family back home, and you can't go on the internet to check out what's going on. So you're very disconnected from the world in general. And so I think that just adds yet another level to the psychological aspect of it.
You can't even see the Earth much of the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So as hard as it is to get to Mars technically, it's also just as hard to imagine how someone could practically do it as a sane astronaut.
And I think that's why they're doing these types of studies. So
it's good to know that they're doing these.
Yeah,
that there is progress being made on that front. Because that's the sort of preparation that has to be done before we actually send real live people.
Another thing that would be interesting would be, of course, the physiological effects of being in space and on Mars for that long. But of course, we can't study that without actually doing it. So there's a lot of factors to think about when we want to think about sending people to Mars, right?
Yeah, some of these astronauts coming back from the space station after 6 months, they can't walk.
Yeah,
right.
Muscle deterioration.
So you send someone to Mars and land him on the surface. If he can't walk, what good is he?
Right, and I mean, you have the lack of gravity on Mars, right? It's only 1/3 of that of Earth, and so that has an effect, of course, on your muscles, but also on your bone mass and the way that your fluids flow through your body. I mean, there's all sorts of things that we have no idea. I mean, it'd be like Marie Curie with her radiation. She had no idea.
Yeah, and the radiation is another factor, of course. Mars doesn't really have the same atmosphere we do, and they are going to be bombarded all the way there, while there, and all the way back.
But let's do it.
Let's make sure some other people do it. Yeah.
Until we have some group who is psychologically very strong to survive the 2-year journey, we can just use robots. We do not need the psychological strength to be comparable.
Yeah, and we don't have to worry about sending them food and fuel and things to launch them back off the surface and come home.
Yeah, but somewhat less cool to just have robots running around forever. like to think that it is the destiny of humanity, as she sort of talked about at the end, that it'll be eventually people walking around, people that we can understand, relate to, that can tell us their experiences.
You know, the question of whether you would send humans all the way there just to do a temporary little walkabout and come home, because that's a long trip.
Yeah.
It's not moon.
Yeah, exactly. Moon. You know, you don't go in a week. If you talk about in the longer term, this idea of imagine colonizing or inhabiting in a long-term way on Mars, you know, we don't know what the gravity and the radiation and things, you know, microgravity seems to be pretty hard on the human physiology, but is 0.3 or 0.4 G, is that worse or better?
Right.
We don't know.
And Mars also has dust storms, which normally cover up the whole rovers we already have there. Yeah. So we also have to take those things in account if it's actually livable by people.
But we know that life is very adaptable, generally over evolutionary timescales, we're pretty sure. But on short times, like to think that people could figure out a way to survive and eventually adapt to the environment.
People just want to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, there's plenty of people who want to.
Even if it's dangerous, even if there's a possibility that they would die, there are plenty of people who would go and do that. I know when I go to the classrooms, I always ask people, who would want to go to Mars? And it's usually about half and half. And we find that, actually, when you go to a planetary conference and you have professors and graduate students, it's usually about half the people who would be, I'd be willing to go. But there's always people who are willing to do that. Yeah. I mean, that's why we have people who climb Mount Everest.
Yeah, it's a challenge, and, you know, trying to imagine, because it's very expensive and very difficult to imagine sending humans to Mars. The point that's often raised is that, what are the economics of this? To do it for science, we had a talk before about whether you can do more science per time and more science per dollar with robots or humans, because humans are very difficult. You'll spend a lot of money trying to get them not to die on the way there of running out of water.
Or not to trip on a rock and rip their spacesuit when they're on the surface. I mean, there's so many things you have to consider. Robots aren't as efficient, of course, in doing the science, but you don't have to worry about that aspect of things.
There's a lot that a human can do just shifting your view a bit to the side to look at something from a slightly different angle. You can do a lot better in vision and in perception and interpretation than a robot is at all capable of doing. But if you want to imagine, what are the costs and to what extent could we fund such a thing? And what would be the return on it? And we talk about, the history of exploration. We were sending people to pick up tea in India and gold in South America. They're not going to bring back either of those things from Mars.
In the grand scheme, I just find it hard to believe, though, that, a few hundred years from now, we're still just doing the same old thing on Earth, and we've never managed to send a single person to the next nearest planet in the solar system. I mean, that just seems like the sort of thing we have to do and will do eventually.
A few hundred years seems reasonable. 15 to 20 years that people are talking about now.
Sky schemes that are never going
to
happen.
Yeah, I mean, it seems a little, there's so much preparation you need to do. I mean, we need to do more and more of these studies where, like Melissa and her crew members did, where they're actually living like they would on Mars. They are in a very isolated area. They don't have access to things. They're not on the internet. They're not talking to their families. They're living on Mars time. They're doing 22 science experiments that they were working on, and simulating it very as closely as possible, because we really need to know what the effects are going to be on these people.
We talk about this is not going to happen for some decades, then we have to make sure that, to the extent that these analog projects are relevant, we have to make sure that the lessons that we learn in them are recorded and are transmitted to the people who will actually design and undertake those missions in the future. Otherwise, the exercise is kind of lost if we don't capture that knowledge and make use of it.
Right, because, of course, these analog missions aren't being done by NASA and ESA.
No. But to hear Melissa talk, it kind of sounds like that's pretty much the person who is going to be going to Mars. So it may very well be that these analog missions are training the actual people that will eventually go. These are the people who are interested in going anyway. Assuming they're still young enough when the time comes along, then maybe they are the people who will go.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts David Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Parshati Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough in time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.